Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, December 2nd. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, money and markets, and then questions and ask Catherine, then a wonderful discussion with Charlie Murray, the president of the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I've been a member for several years, and it's an organization I recommend strongly to all of you. Then, in Let's Go to the Movies, The Art of the Steal, a documentary about the Barnes Foundation's incredible collection of Impressionist paintings and the battle to move the collection from the suburbs of Philadelphia down into the Parkway in downtown Philadelphia. As I described in the Sidley report that we did with Axel Merck at November 18th, one of the reasons that I'm in Philadelphia for this six-week period is helping a very dear old family friend, childhood friend, navigate between independent living and assisted living, and with some interim stops now in both hospital and nursing facility. And I've learned a tremendous about the challenges of the American healthcare system. If you know me, you know I avoid that system like the plague. And my father was a surgeon, and he, among other things, taught me to avoid it like the plague. But it's interesting because my friend was someone who has lived through a series of health and physical challenges over the last 10 years, and she's someone who has always been excellent at planning and done not only a great job of planning her legal and financial affairs, but also doing it collaboratively with her support network and the people that she's chose to help her. And I have watched her over the last two decades really succeed and survive in a variety of circumstances that would have failed other people, because she had great planning and she had built a really smart network of people who cared about her and who were prepared to help her. The reason I'm in Philadelphia for the 6 weeks is literally a year ago, and then 6 months ago I started to plan to be here because I anticipated that she might need me. So it's a perfect example of why the kind of planning that Charlie Murray can and his organization can help us do is so valuable. It's it's something that can really make a difference. A little bit of intelligence and planning ahead can make an enormous difference, and I'm watching that in action over the last 2 weeks. Our theme tonight is We Can Do This, one of my favorite books and one of the sort of books that will be in the top 20 books of the Solari Report is Lawrence Gonzalez's book, Deep Survival. Lawrence was on the Solari Report in 2009. You can listen to it in the archive. If you haven't heard that one, please listen. It's just fabulous. And it's a book that we can all use. It's about survival in the wilderness, but it really, it's great lessons for how to be successful in life in anything you do. One of the important things he talks about is why it's so important to do whatever you can do with whatever is under your control. And good financial planning and collaborative planning with family and friends, at least the members that you know and trust, is something we can all do, and we tend to avoid it because it can be very depressing, particularly in this day and age. And I know I kind of feel like, oh, I have enough negative to deal with without doing more of this. Who wants to think about getting sick or being disabled or having an accident or even dying? But even though there's enough bad news without contemplating this, if you live in Europe or North America or Japan, you're facing living in a world with an aging population. And in America, particularly, we're going to have to grapple with helping or being people who are doing so in a system that is, in many respects, may not be friendly or at least supportive. I put up a story last week on the blog, a wonderful story, and you see this kind of story more and more, of a farmer in New Zealand who got swine flu and ended up in the intensive care unit, and the doctors wanted to pull life support. And the family was very insistent and ultimately had to go out and get a lawyer and wanted a vitamin C therapy and fought. And the guy's walking around and is fine today, but only because he had a family prepared to move him through and advocate. So dealing in these kinds of environments can be very risky business, and we need to learn to do it well. because it can extend our life and protect our health, and the same for people we love. So that's my 2 minutes on the soapbox. Money and markets. Europe, we see running hits on Greece and Ireland. I suggested last time that you read the Palast interview. I've put it up on the blog. Greg Palast illuminating these kind of backdoor IMF deals in Latin America, but now, of course, we're seeing it move into the first world. It's starting with the weaker countries in Ireland. But we talked in the interview I did of Richard Dolan, we talked about the breakaway civilization, and that includes sort of the dark pool and high yield sort of games quietly in the banking system. And the problem with that system is it really is like a tapeworm, and it constantly need new hits. And Ireland, if they go forward with the deal, is going to be the new source of subsidy. We all have a vested interest in seeing Ireland stand up over this issue and stand up over the issue of centralization versus decentralization. So let's see what happens. The Irish are a fierce people, and it's hard to tell from the media what's really going on, but we'll know soon enough. North America, Rasmussen reports, interestingly enough, consumer confidence highest since February 2008. Despite that uptick, only 10% rate the economy is good or excellent. 34% say they're upbeat about the overall economy. 31% say the economy is getting better, while 46% believe it's getting worse. When I drove up to New Hampshire for Thanksgiving and stopped in Massachusetts to do a variety of meetings, the shopping malls were packed, the roads were packed. There was no indication that things were bleak. Now, at the same time, we're seeing the news from Congress that they intend to not extend the unemployment benefits. That's going to hit millions of people very hard, so it will be quite interesting to see what happens there. It's called the Food Safety Bill. You've heard me talk about it a lot. I call it the Food Command and Control Bill. It did pass the Senate. Oddly enough, there was a glitch, and it's hard to imagine this was an accident, but on a procedural issue, it's a very important one. There's a revenue-raising provision, and the Senate cannot originate a revenue-raising provision, and there's real hope that this provision will kill the bill. Now, the politics have gotten quite mixed. Tester of Montana put an amendment that is supposed to protect small farms. We've seen a lot of communications from groups holding themselves to be on the progressive side of the fence, hoping that this bill passes, saying, you know, it's kind of good to stop all sorts of corporate abuses. The reality is the more centralized control and the more rules, the worse it's going to be for the small farmers and sort of food freedom. So there's real hope that if this if the revenue raising procedural problems hold it up, we have one senator saying we won't see a food bill for 10 years, from his lips to spirit's ears. So let us pray. Interestingly enough, we had hope that the Senate was going to find a way to cancel the provision that businesses have to provide a W-2 form for all payments over $600. This is kind of the Barry Small Business and Paperwork Act. The lawmakers couldn't agree to a way to make up the revenue requirement. You know, it's very frustrating because their projection of how much revenue is going to come from this, I think, is grossly overestimated completely, assuming, you know, especially if you integrate in the assumption that it's as dampening to business and small businesses, I think it will be. At the same time, we're saying we can come up with a revenue to justify extension of the Bush tax cuts. So the combination of action on the $600 provision, the Bush tax cuts, and the refusal to extend unemployment benefits sends a very very clear message that if you have no political power and are not adding value to the stock market, you know, watch out in the political process. In Asia, we continue to get reports of extremely high retail demand for precious metals. It's almost like everybody in Asia is saying the country and the businesses have to take dollars, but we choose not to. You all have heard me use the expression the Midianite thing, but let me just remind you, it's from the story in the Judges in the Old Testament. of Gideon throwing the Midianites out of Israel. And what happens is the Midianites jump up in the dark and they're so hateful and suspicious that they kill each other. And so I often refer to the Midianite thing happening as we watch different political factions fight. And the struggle between the breakaway civilization and sort of the dark pools in the banking system have reached new heights. The Madoff trustee just today announced they're suing J.P. Morgan. Now, this case could get very interesting because, in fact, J.P. Morgan was Madoff's lead bank for 20-plus years. There's no way this kind of fraud could have gone on without their active involvement and support. And so if the Madoff trustee thinks they can get billions back from J.P. Morgan, it's inconceivable to me based on the facts that there isn't a strong legal case. Now, of course, what happens? Who knows? It'll be very interesting to see. I'm very curious to know if J.P. Morgan's error and omissions insurance company is going to cover this one. So there's going to be a lot going on in this one that's interesting. What could get particularly interesting if it doesn't settle quickly but gets litigated out is some serious questions about the operation of the dark pools can be asked. And if you thought, J.P. Morgan having its skirts lifted is an indication of the Midianite thing, the next one is Nigeria is now indicating that they intend to bring criminal charges against Dick Cheney. This reported by Business Week. They're saying the prosecuting counsel of what's called the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission in Nigeria is saying that the arrest warrant will be issued and transmitted through Interpol, presumably the same Interpol that is issuing an arrest warrant for the head of WikiLeaks. So you wonder if this is part of, a related whack-whack. Nigeria has arrested 12 employees of Halliburton earlier this week, according to Reuters. And this relates to a bribery scandal that occurred while Cheney was running Halliburton. But if you look at Halliburton's role in the breakaway civilization, this fight is getting quite dirty. My suspicion is, if you take a look at the WikiLeaks story, which has burned up quite a lot of time on the Internet this week, it's clear WikiLeaks is getting downloads from various factions deep inside the system. So it's quite interesting, and as you know, I'm a great believer in transparency, so it's interesting to see each other fight. I remember when I was in the Bush administration, one of the assistant secretaries who worked with me turned to me and she said, it's like being on a rubber boat and everybody's going at each other with razor blades, or a rubber raft and everybody's going at each other with razor blades, but I suspect given these two announcements this week, we're going to see the Midianite thing continue to accelerate. So, keep an eye because it's going to get quite interesting. Media, as you know, I talked last time about how suspicious I am about the TSA, this sort of grassroots uprising against the TSA. And it was very interesting to see that announced. The new procedures at TSA were announced on October 28th, just as the food bill effort got hot and heavy, and sure enough were canceled, or there's an announcement that they canceled, and Drudge, who was credited with leading that campaign, got it done really earlier, sort of November 30th timeframe, after the Senate had passed the food bill. So I think, in a situation like this, these kind of events have multivariate equations and different agendas that they're trying to accomplish. But if you look at what is a greater threat to our liberties and freedoms, the food bill was a far greater threat than being groped at the airport, no matter how unpleasant that was, or being radiated. So I'd rather get groped and not radiated than have my food radiated. So, we're just going to keep watching the food bill, but it was interesting. It was the timing of the two was interesting and I suspect connected. Equity markets were continuing to see equity outflows, and yet the market continues to levitate. There clearly is very significant central bank support. Precious metals, as I said last time, I think the central banks are going to hold the line at 25%. The gold-silver ratio continues to drop Franklin and the money changer are planning on trading at 47.5. We, Solaris Silver and Gold, is conferred, and we are recommending only to a selective number of clients to trade at that ratio. The clients that we're recommending have significant realized gains or are in an IRA, have a significant position, and are comfortable with the concept, and the logistics are manageable for them. Because we're much newer than the money changer, our clients' investments are generally at a lower ratio, and we just don't want to trade if the commissions and transaction costs are a major portion of the realized gains. So we're doing it selectively. Mahira this week, it's very interesting. It's the subscriber who recommended The Art of the Steal. I can't thank you enough. This is quite a gem of a documentary, and I don't know that I would ever have found it. I find our subscribers are sending us wonderful questions, wonderful ideas, and great recommendations of both stories and documentaries. So for the subscriber who recommended Art of the Steal, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate it. Okay, some questions in Ask Catherine. Hi, Catherine, would you be able to lay out the plans for what the government has set up as control of the pension funds, such as what types of funds? Would they take public or private? Would they take funds that have stocks and bonds in them, or just money market IRAs, et cetera? If you're interested in the changes that are being discussed for IRAs and 401ks, I would go to the blog and do a search for IRAs, and you'll pull them up. We've done quite a bit, and David Lichty did a wonderful article about a month ago showing some of the proposals for annuitization. That's one set of proposals. The big risks in pension funds, I think, are not sort of the Argentina kind of confiscation, but rather a debasement of value as a result of debasement of the currency and continued management of explosion of government debt and bad paper. So, for example, the pension funds bought a tremendous amount of the housing and mortgage paper, and that paper has lost value as a result of the fall of the dollar and the different credit quality issues as a result of what we've seen happen in the last couple of years. And I also think there's a great deal of siphoning off in the back door. I can't prove it in a court of law, but I think, and a lot of that comes in what it buys and what it doesn't buy. So I think, I don't think the pension funds will experience an Argentina kind of bailout, but I think there's been a tremendous sort of enervation of value through ways that are a lot less visible. WikiLeaks, could it be a move to discredit internet and to make people accept strict internal controls? After all, the leaks are not very serious reactions in the official media about stealing documents, bad journalism, and making diplomacy impossible. It could be that, but I think, you know, there's a push for internet controls that are coming from many different places. I think WikiLeaks is more about people dishing dirt out on each other, and it's much more of a high level food fight, and I do think ultimately that the transparency is positive if you take the long view. Diversifying out of precious metals into rental properties. I have accumulated six figures of precious metals and now want to begin diversifying into rental properties specializing in Section 8 in Ohio. What chance would there be of Section 8 being cut in a further dramatic decline in financial markets? I would just say, having run the Section 8 program a long time ago and watched its evolution, that there are many arguments to be made to taking a position in income-producing property and markets properties where that can provide a respectable yield and give you a tangible investment. However, I would not invest in anything that's dependent on government income flows. The chances of those programs being cut or just simply the expense of managing it getting trickier and trickier and various political problems are serious. So I would be much more inclined to look at rental property that can attract an income from a market tenant as opposed to some government subsidy. My husband and I, question on debt. My husband and I are fortunate that we are comfortably paying our debt obligations each month Is it more prudent to pay just over the minimum each month and take the extra money to stock up on food, gold, silver, and other tangible items that we might need in the event of another Great Depression? If there is a serious collapse, what would happen to our debt? A lot of this depends on your unique circumstance, and it's hard to answer in the general. I would say, though, that even over the last 5 years, even though there's been an argument to, for example, invest in precious metals rather than paying down your debt, because clearly debt denominated in dollars is being debased, and that can work for you. However, the reality is in a serious economic collapse, there's going to be a debt collector who thinks you owe that debt, and I think debt has dangers. So I would be extremely careful, and getting debt-free, I think, is always a prudent thing to do. But a lot of the specifics are going to make sense in the particular case. A question on how to invest in gold in an IRA. If you go to the Solaris Silver and Gold website, and we have a whole section on investing in precious metals through your IRA. So definitely check it out. Finally, setting up a microfinancing offering to raise money for local businesses, how to do any examples. We did a Solari report on Solari Circles. I would really encourage you to take a very careful look at the proposed document we had for doing private equity investment with a circle in your community doing local investment. I think that structure, which we worked very carefully with and our attorneys, can help inform you of one way of going about it that keeps you working within the state parameters. Now, very important, and if you listen to that audio seminar, we'll or that Solari report will tell you the same thing, very important to check out with your local attorneys because each state differs, and as you said, you're in Florida, Tennessee, and California, so different state laws in different states. Okay, on to organizing your legal and financial affairs with Charlie Murray. This is really a wonderful opportunity for me because I've been a member of the American Institute of Economic Research in Massachusetts for several years. I read a lot of their reports. I read a lot of their books. I recommend to clients and subscribers a lot of their materials for financial planning. And Charles is the, or Charlie, as I now call him, is the president and chief executive officer. He's been at the Institute since 1998, first as a senior economist and director of the fellowship programs. He then became director of research and education and then president in 2003. He's taught economics at Truman State University and Iowa State University. He has his PhD from Iowa State. So this is someone who knows economics. And, Charlie, it's a pleasure to have you on the Solari Report.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Catherine.
Well, there's so many of your products that I love and recommend, but the two that I wanted to focus on and just hit some of the highlights are, first I wanted to talk about avoiding financial tangles, because you guys have a wonderful sense of sort of the common big mistakes we make, and I would love it if you would just walk through some of the big ones, and some of the ones you cover, and how to avoid financial tangles.
Well, I think one of the problems, Catherine, that people run into is they don't have a plan or a sense of where they want to go or what they want, and in a sense they're just wandering around, and you're more prone to find yourself in a financial tangle if you're just kind of wandering around being sold financial products and so forth. So one thing that we recommend right off is to have a plan of some sort. And then the other big financial tangle that we think people get into is not being in control. And part of that's not having a plan, but relying on friends, family members' advice, professionals, and so forth, salespeople. And you can get into a lot of trouble but by not taking control of your own financial affairs. That doesn't mean that you can't get advice, but on the other hand, you have to be responsible for your own financial affairs.
Well, it's interesting. If you simply wander around the world and try and learn about, okay, so I say, I want to have a plan, and So how do I get a plan? And you just start dipping into the financial world. They make it sound so complicated. And it doesn't have to be. And I think that's what I love about the Institute is you have a way of breaking it down and making it so that something who really doesn't want to become a financial expert can understand.
Well, one of the things, and this gets to the heart of the Institute and really why I came out of academics to go and work at the Institute, is the Institute doesn't have any political ties. It doesn't have any ties with industry. We don't take, you know, any corporate donations or donations from large individuals. So our mission, and we are a nonprofit, is just to help people help themselves. So, we don't have, favor one financial approach over another. We figure that most of our people are just, you know, workaday folks. Work hard to make money. They don't have a lot of time to fool around with investing and so forth. They have a family and they have other interests. And so, you know, what types of advice do they need to just secure their financial future? And a lot of the things are fairly simple. So, for example, you know, when it comes to life insurance, people certainly need life insurance. But if you really break it down, people should just get term life insurance and invest the difference. They don't need sophisticated investment products. We also, as far as investing, we tend to take a passive approach. We believe markets work and that things are more or less priced correctly.
That's the one place where you and I disagree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not that, and this would be a good thing to have a conversation about, because we believe that there are extra returns that you can earn if you put the extra time and effort into finding those. And,
right.
And, some people just, they're not going to do that, so they should just more or less, you know, act as though the products are all, priced fairly. So we would readily accept, the your argument, but you work very hard to get the extra returns.
The one of the things I love is the idea of don't buy too big a house. It's funny because I've spent a lot of time in the housing world in my life, and if you look at how much capital Americans have poured into houses, a lot of what they think is increase in value is not that. It's just buying bigger. It's consuming bigger and bigger and bigger spaces to live in, and we've poured an incredible amount of capital into what is really consumption and not investment.
Yeah, well, that's one of our... Yeah, we're a little bit contrarian when it comes to a lot of notions that people hear. We look at a house as consumption. Or a realtor will tell you it's an investment. You know, buy as much house as you possibly can. We would disagree with that. We think it's basically consumption. What you do is, you know, buy a house that fits your lifestyle and what you need. I think Americans were sold on the idea that, you know, keep plowing as much money into housing as that you possibly can. Besides the financial risk, some of these big houses, just keeping them clean, keeping the yard up. It's an albatross around your neck. I think the Americans now are on the trending to downsize and so forth. So we think the same kind of logic applies to cars. Buy a car that you can afford and kind of treat it as a consumption good, as a depreciating asset, and you probably shouldn't put a whole lot of money into a fancy car. Now, if you need your car for work, I knew a guy that spent more time, he was a pharmaceutical salesman, spent more time on the road than he did in his house. So he had a nicer car than he did apartment. So I can fully understand that. Or, you know, if you're driving clients around or whatever, then I fully understand that the car is more than just transportation. But again, you can just overinvest in some of these goods that are really nothing more than depreciating assets, and you'd never want to do that.
I have a wonderful friend who's one of the smartest guys I know who decided he was going to figure out what was the most thermodynamically correct car to drive. So what car was the kindest to the environment? If you wanted to be, you know, kind to the environment, what car would you drive? So he studied and did numbers, and it was a big project. And he came back and he said, here's what you do. You drive your car forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I have now 267,000 miles on my car. The Nissan folks tell me it can go 400,000, and that's my goal, is to get it to go 400,000.
Well, just for your audience, in our book, we have a book, Driving Bargains. We figured out that, you know, your first biggest purchase, of course, is housing, and then it's transportation. And over, you know, a 50-year driving career, a car will cost as much as a house. So, again, just over time, you know, the difference between a $25,000 car and a $30,000 car, you know, can be $50,000.
Right.
So, people think in terms of, oh, health care is expensive, but, you know, housing is very expensive, and next in line is transportation.
Right. You have a couple I want to just run through quickly, too. I like this feeling obligated to hire and lend to friends and family. I'm a great believer in gifting to family.
It may turn out, it probably will turn out to be a gift.
Right.
You have to be really careful when you lend or go into business with friends and family.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can love them, but again, a lot of times, you know, if you do lend, a lot of times it turns sour anyway, and then there's still hard feelings. So maybe your listener should believe in tough love. In other words, that I love you, but I'm not gonna do this unless it's some amount that's insignificant or whatever that you can afford to do it as a gift, as you say.
Buying inappropriate financial products. It's another one.
Well, I think that happens all the time when people, instead of, again, when you don't have a plan and you go out to buy things, you tend to get sold things. And,
right.
Again, you go out, and if you don't know what kind of insurance you want to buy, let's say life insurance, the salesperson isn't going to recommend term insurance to you because the commission on term insurance isn't that high. They'll try to sell you some kind of sophisticated insurance. Or if you go and you get, let's say, a free investment advice, financial plan, well, the salesperson is probably going to try to sell you the mutual funds that they have to offer. So, when it comes to finances, you should have a plan and go out and be a buyer rather than just kind of wandering around and being sold financial products.
I think it's getting better now, but what I found is it's hard for many people to fathom that there's an entire infrastructure of people selling you things that are inappropriate for you and that they have no conscience about doing that. In other words, they will do that. And
part of the thing, and again, there's it could be deviousness on the part of the salesperson, but a lot of these salespeople just aren't you know, they aren't that bright, giving you that great advice to begin with.
Right.
So you know that some kid that's fresh out of college, you know, has a lot to learn about the financial industry, and you know, you should be suspect to just even if you do know, you should be suspect of the advice that they're giving you.
One of the things I just want to mention quickly, I love Driving Bargains. That's another book of yours that I have and recommend. Another book that I love is your chart book. It's called, I think the subtitle is Economic Trends at a Glance. And I think one of the things that really helps me have a plan is understanding the long-term trends. And the chart book is great at sitting back. I'll never forget, Charlie, when I... Do you have one chart in the chart book that shows selected components of the Consumer Price Index 1978 to 2009. The price of televisions from 1978 to 2010, today it's 8% of what it was in 1978, yet the price of tuition and school fees is 1,000, I mean, it's 10 times what it was. So tuition and school fees have gone up a multiple of 10 times, and television has dropped to 1/10. Now, what does that say about our sources of information? Anyway, but I looked at it and I said, holy cow, you know, if I were a young person getting out of college, I need to rethink how I'm going to arrange my education. Anyway, so I just want to also put in a plug for that chart book, because I think it really helps you see the very big picture.
Yeah, we take a lot of pride in the charts we do, and the chart book is a culmination of different charts we've used in different articles from our newsletter over the year.
Uh-huh.
And we, you know, did a lot of neat charts, and we thought, well, why not just collect them into a book? And the idea is that, you know, there's no words in there. They're just charts, and because they're supposed to be self-explaining. In other words, you don't need a lot of text. So it's kind of neat to just flip through there and see the different stories that are in there. The one that we like a lot is the one of the value of the dollar over time. In other words,
that's the one I'm
along,
looking at. The purchasing power.
Going along on the gold standard and the dollar sort of maintaining its value, and then we go off the gold standard and it just takes a nosedive and then it drops precipitously. And we actually have a poster sized chart that we offer that depicts that.
Yeah.
One thing I do want to mention for the people that are listening that if they go on our website AIER.org and they can get any of our publications for half off using the code Solari. So I'd like to.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Mention that.
Okay, so let's turn. This is sort of my current favorite for the last year. You have a workbook by Marla Brill called "If Something Should Happen: How to Organize Your Financial and Legal Affairs." And simply because I'm a financial advisor, we're required to have, or an investment advisor, we're required to have a disaster recovery plan. And I'm very big on having, you know, digital copies of all our records in multiple places, and, you know, so that if anything happens. Anyway, so I'm very big on all of this stuff. And this is a workbook that will literally take you, if you're a busy person and you don't want to be bothered doing this kind of planning, it will really help you, you know, walk through what are all the issues, what are all the things you need to think about, how do you organize, set it up, how do you, you know, it's just a very practical little workbook, and I just think it makes what can be seem a completely overwhelming and complicated topic, I think it just makes it so simple and understandable. So I thought maybe we could talk through some of the key issues, and I'd like to highlight, you know, some of the kinds of risks that you face if you haven't done this. So maybe why don't you just tell us how this book came to be?
Well, it came to be because we've had people at work, you know, go through what you were talking about earlier. In other words, they just needed somebody to help. And even if you have a relationship that's very open and communicative, say with your spouse, there's a lot of things that even my wife, even though we make all our financial decisions together and talk about finances all the time, there's things we don't know about each other. So for example, in other words, that she may not know all the benefits that I have at work. So, for example, I have a life insurance policy not only for myself at work, but I have one for her, you know, that I receive as a benefit.
Uh-huh.
She may not even, you know, she may not even know that. So it's just that we all have multiple accounts. I have retirement accounts from Truman State University that she may not know about because I didn't meet my wife until after then. So, you know, it's not that we're keeping secrets. We just have secrets, if you will. So what that book was really about is, you know, we sat around and that book was really a collaborative effort with Marla Brill and Carrie Lynch and some of our other staff members. Most of our books, even if they have a single author name, they're quite often collaborative efforts. And we just said, well, what would you need to know? And we've done books on estate planning and so forth, but we, you know, they get fairly complicated fairly quickly. And the key of this book when we started was to keep it simple. In other words, what do you need to know, but, you know, don't make it complicated. And the other thing we even did when we first did it was made it the ugliest color yellow that you could find. It was an ugly mustard color.
Uh-huh.
And so if somebody needed to find the book, it's an ugly mustard colored book. You can't miss it. So it was that was kind of done with a purpose. So the idea is it walks you all through your bank accounts. Do you have life insurance? A lot of things on Medicare or medical, of course, because, you know, that's probably the time that the book will need to be used. And just, you know, where are accounts, where are things, what kind of pills should the, even what kind of pills or what kind of care do the dogs get?
Right.
Because if, you know, you need somebody to step in and be you or run your life, we have a lot of things that we do every day for ourselves, that we know about, and they're all locked up in, you know, in our head, but somebody else would need to get in essentially in our head and run our affairs. So,
there are a couple things I want to talk about that I think are really, really important. And one is the healthcare proxy. Maybe if you could just describe what a healthcare proxy is and why it's so important.
Well, a healthcare proxy lets somebody else know what your wishes are, and they can make the decisions for you. And it's, you know, it's a legal document, and it's very important to have one. I remember that when my mother had a massive stroke, and she didn't want any extraordinary efforts made, you know, to keep her alive. So that made it very easy on the family, in the end to ultimately make the decision. And she, you know, stipulated other, you know, thank God she was thoughtful enough to go through the process of thinking about, you know, the sort of the end game, if you will. And made it so that we did it her way, and it made it very easy on us, is that we didn't have to second guess what she wanted. So a healthcare proxy is probably the most important thing that's in that book.
Right. I'll tell you why, because I've run into a whole series of situations where you get into a situation where the hospital is doing what it's doing to protect its risk, as opposed to doing what the patient, if they were strong enough to argue their case, thinks is the most supportive of them. So the, you know, sort of the policies of what the hospital is doing is different than what the family might want or the patient might want if they could argue it. And at that point, if you don't have someone in the family who has the proxy and has the legal authority to say, no, you're, you know, this or that, you run the risk of literally the state becoming the guardian, as opposed to, you know, the patient can or they can't represent themselves at that point, and they really need an advocate, and you're a much stronger advocate if you have that proxy.
Oh, there's no doubt. In fact, you mentioned the state tends to take control, not only of healthcare, but if you die without a will, you know, it's the laws that decide what you want to do, or the government that decides, rather than you decide. You know, the government's not necessarily going to decide have the same view of things or fulfill your wishes. So one of the things, and that again gets back to you know, we need to be in control.
Right.
Or once you abdicate that, then other people start making those decisions for you.
Right, you know, and you're better off if it's somebody who loves you as opposed to some stranger.
That's exactly right.
It's changing just like with every shift.
And another example is that with your 401k now, they force everybody to be in a 401k, and if you don't make your selections, then you know you're just stuck in the default choice of whatever your employer is, and the employer wants to cover their butts, of course, so they'll put you in, you know, a money market or whatever.
Right.
So you just have to. You know, and it's tough to do, you know, to be in make a lot of decisions and so forth. And some of it is, you know, you never want to think of bad things happening to you and so forth. But, if you think about it, even worse things could happen. So, you do want to think about these things, not only for yourself, but for your loved ones. I mean, you know, in other words, I was just so happy that my mother had essentially gone through the process. And, I don't, you know, I know she tended to avoid doing those things, but she found the energy, to go ahead and do it. So, and even kids should feel, you know, I've encouraged my kids, to fill out the if something should happen, because they have things that I don't know about, you know. They have things that were given to them and so forth, handed down through the family, and what who would they like to have those things and so forth. So even kids, you know, young adults, when I talk about kids, I mean young adults. I'm getting older now, but anyway, that they should look through the if something should happen and write down, you know, what they have is where and so forth. It's
I agree. I think it's, you know, it gets you thinking ahead, and you know, and perhaps speeding less in your car.
Well, and also it gives you a chance to kind of review where you are, because you might think, you know, I don't have enough life, and you know, maybe I should get my life insurance reviewed, because as you go through life and your circumstances change, you know, so you need to make changes, and you know, the life insurance you need when you're 25 years old is different than when you're 45 and you have two kids, or when you're, you know, when you're 65.
Right.
So, you know, just kind of don't just do the book and throw it on the shelf and forget about it. You know, you might grab it, you know, every 5 years or anytime you have a change in circumstances, whether it's a job or you get married or you get divorced or you have kids or whatever. Anytime your circumstances change, you really should you know, review your plan and what types of insurance you have and how your 401k beneficiaries are named and all that kind of stuff.
Another thing that I've seen cause lots of either, you know, success because you had it and problems because you didn't, is if nobody has a power of attorney for the finances, you know, you're sitting in the hospital, and meantime your electricity is getting turned off because somebody hasn't paid your bill. And so maybe if you could say a little bit about the power of attorney for the finances.
Well, again, that's just as important as the healthcare proxy. And one of the things that you have to be careful with is who you name,
right?
Who you give that power of attorney to, and to the extent you can, you would use probably some sort of limited power of attorney. So, for example, you know, they might not have the power of attorney over all your assets, but certain assets, as you said, you know, keep the household running if something should happen. So again, that's
right, and you can split it out so that eventually, for anything big to happen, it's got to be the committee.
Yeah, sure. Right. For example, you know, I've had, you know, power of attorney to buy a car or something for somebody, and that was it. So very limited power of attorney. Lots of times, you might give your financial advisor limited power of attorney to, you know, buy and sell assets in the account. So, again, you want to be very careful when
right.
you give that power of attorney to, and also, to the extent that you can limit it to what you need to have done. Another neat thing, and it's not in that book, and it's not in the How to Avoid Financial Tangles, but if we have any people in the audience that are thinking of getting married, one of the neat things that my wife's parents did was set up what was called a runaway account. In other words, that we didn't commingle all our money when we got married. She had a separate account with enough money in it to sort of go out and start fresh. So that if something happens to you know, in other words, she needs to get out or whatever, I thought that was always kind of a neat thing. That was something I had never heard. Well, I had never heard of it.
Uh-huh.
Still to this day, she has, you know, that separate account, and it's got enough in it for her to essentially get out and go out and start fresh. And I just thought, geez, that's something that I want to make sure that I do for my daughter. And I just thought that was neat. I thought it was worth mentioning because I've never seen it written, you know, down anywhere. So she, you know, she doesn't have to go to anybody. I mean, that money is just, and I don't even know where it is. And even after 24 years, she still has it. But I just thought that was a neat thing that I've never seen.
Now, one of the things you do cover, which to me is very, very important, is keeping records and organizing your records. I'll never forget, I took two trips down to New Orleans to go to conferences after Katrina and ended up talking to many, many people about their experiences. And you heard two kinds of experiences, people who had a copy of all their records and were able to get back up and running relatively smoothly, and people who lost all their records and were just devastated. And so one of the things you really learned was the importance to a quick recovery of having great archives on legal and financial records.
One way is, of course, keep some of the stuff in a safe deposit box. But again, if the bank gets flooded, I guess they'd be ruined too. But I think one of the things technology may be helping us out is that you can scan some of these documents and then keep them, you know, keep them electronically and safekeep them that way. So,
right.
The other thing is you mentioned, you know, keeping records. We tend to be, in my family, very good about keeping records. We just don't keep them organized very well. So we tend to have every piece of paper that we need to have. We just don't know where they all are and can lay our hands on them very quickly. So I would say the advice there is keep the records and keep them organized if you can.
Right. Well, something, if something should happen is a great little tool. And, you know, I do, what I've seen again and again is people who take the time to do this kind of planning, particularly in a collaborative basis, it means if they get cornered, it in many cases it makes a big difference. So this is, you know, I just want to say this is not necessarily about going off and figuring out, you know, how to die well. It's about going out and figuring out how to make sure in a pinch you've got the support you need so that you make it through. So, you know, I think this is just a great investment of people's time. And I can't thank you enough for providing this. If you could just briefly mention again how we find the website and how we get that 50% discount.
Okay, if you go to AIER.org, that's our website, and then we do have a bookstore, and it's you know where you go, and people are familiar with how to type in a code, and the code we'll use is Solari, because you were so kind in having us on, and you can get 50% off any of our publications, books, newsletters, and so forth.
Well, you know, Charlie, you guys are making it fashionable to live modestly. And to me, one of the best ways of building net worth is to live modestly. And I can't thank you enough for it. I think it's great.
Well, I appreciate being on your show.
Okay. You have a wonderful evening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Charles Murray, President of the American Institute of Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Okay. The Art of the Steal. The Art of the Steal is a documentary. I grew up in Philadelphia, so it's near and dear to my heart. It tells the story of the Barnes Collection, which is a collection of Impressionist paintings put together by a Dr. Albert Barnes, who invented, was an inventor and sold his product, made a fair amount of money, and really did a remarkable job of collecting Impressionist paintings during that period. And there was one review of the... I just want to grab it. I'm just going online to get it for you. There was one review of the documentary that just said it beautifully. It was Roger Ebert in the Chicago Sun-Times. It's perfectly clear exactly what Barnes specified in his will. As background, Barnes had endowed a foundation and asked that the collection be kept for educational purposes in Lower Merion, in a format where it was hard for people to see it, or a lot of people to see it easily. It's perfectly clear exactly what Barnes specified in his will. It was drawn up by the best legal minds. It is clear what happened to his collection was against his wishes. It is clear that the city fathers, that's of Philadelphia, acted in obviation of those wishes and were upheld in a court of appeals. What is finally clear, it doesn't matter a damn what your will says, if you have $25 billion and politicians in the establishments want it. What has happened, and which is explained remarkably well in The Art of the Steal, the sort of legal steps taken, an agreement has been made through the courts to move this amazing art collection down to the Parkway, really in violation of the will. It's as a documentary, it's a great commentary on estate planning and sort of how to think through all the different ways a will can be, or the wishes of the party can be, as they said here, obviated. Now, the documentary, another comment from Rotten Tomatoes, deeply esoteric and unapologetically one-sided. The Art of the Steal proves the documentary doesn't have to make an objective argument as long as it argues well. So the people who made the documentary are clearly outraged at the effort by a variety of interests in Philadelphia to get the will, or to get the rules of the game changed and to move the Barnes Foundation downtown. I would like to take a more balanced approach. If you are responsible for economic development and for creating economic value in downtown Philadelphia, having a collection that is this beautiful and this remarkable down on the Parkway near the Art Museum is going to be an amazing tourist attraction. And so when you have an asset that is this valuable and is this something that is so desired to be seen and observed by many, many people, you can see that there is a real balance between observing the wishes of Dr. Barnes and his will and the desire to create a real asset on the Parkway in Philadelphia that's going to attract an awful lot of tourist dollars to the city, and if you're the governor or the mayor, it's very hard to not want to make that happen, because it's all part of building a strong economy, and art and culture are very, very critical to building strong economies and to building the life and place of a community. So having a collection that valuable and that important in a format where it's harder to see, you can see the pressures on them to move it. So I see it with more of a balanced view. At the same time, my attitude is, you know, I'm a great believer in the rule of law. And clearly this is a perfect example of how powerful interests can basically override a will and override clearly what the law is. And it's a fascinating documentary because it gives you an example of that. And there's tremendous amounts of eye candy because you get to see a very, very beautiful, a very, very beautiful collection of Impressionist paintings. You get to walk through the Barnes Foundation and see it. So if you haven't been to Lower Merion to see it, I recommend it because you get to see it and hear a story of a very interesting and amazing man and the collection he put together, which is ultimately the important thing is the beauty and the power of his what he did in his collection and his life's work and that of the artist. So there's a lot of beauty to be seen. So I recommend strongly, again, our hero this week is the subscriber who recommended it. Thank you very, very much. It's really quite a remarkable documentary. If you're interested in the art world, you really enjoy it. Okay, closing. December 9th next week, Precious Metals Market Report. The precious metals continues to remain high. It's looks like December is going to be another high point, as it has been for 5 of the last 10 years, so we have a lot to talk about. December 16, Who Rules with Daniel Eschelin, who's the author of the book on the Bilderbergers and the Shadow Masters. He spent a lifetime covering sort of who's really in control. And that was a request from subscribers, got a lot of support. And so we contacted his publisher and have arranged for him to join us on December 16th. Who Rules? January 7th, very important year-end wrap-up. The Road Turns East was our phrase for 2010, and so we're going to do that year-end wrap-up. That's going to be a very good one. Remember, if you have one help to diversify your assets with precious metals, call David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, or I at Solaria Silver and Gold. We're delighted to help and support. And remember, until next week when we get together with Franklin for the Precious Metals Report, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.